This interview is taking place on the 23rd of November 2005 and is with Derek Parsons, a resident of Burton Bradstock. In August 2005, the village celebrated the 60th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and an exhibition commemorated those who had served to secure victory over Japan in 1945. Derek was one of those people. He is a veteran of Four Corps, part of the 14th Army, which is called the Forgotten Army. He served as a captain in a survey regiment in the Royal Artillery in India and Burma between 1943 and 1945, and he took part in the Great Battle of Koima Imphal on the Indo-Burmese frontier, which closed the gate of India to the Japanese and was a turning point in the war against Japan. Derek, what exactly does a survey regiment do?
Well, it does three things in particular. Mainly, it locates enemy guns, but it also surveys the area required for operations by putting all the guns, medium and heavy in particular, onto the same grid, that is, map grid, so that if they're given a map reference of an enemy gun, they will all be firing on the right spot. The other two important elements in a survey regiment are flash spotting. They have little teams of men, about three or four men, who are set apart by perhaps a few hundred yards, overlooking the area of operations and looking for, through binoculars, and their binoculars fixed to a base with 360 degrees on it. And they are, when they see a flash of an enemy gun, they all pounce on it, and their readings from this 360 degree base are sent to a central point, and that enables a plotter to pinpoint the exact spot on the map. The other method of locating is by sound ranging, and when sound ranging, you put out a base of probably about 100 yards or 150 yards long of six, what we used to call microphones, in dustbins. They were dug in the ground and camouflaged, but they were little microphones. And ahead of them, way up with the infantry, was a man who would activate these microphones, and they would send back a little blip when the noise of a gun hit them, and it would show up on a film, which looks awfully like the sort of film you get when there is an eruption or an earthquake, the Richter scale. It looks exactly like that. And again, that base gives different readings and enables you to locate the gun by sound. So that's the duty of a survey regiment.
Obviously crucial to any regiment in any war.
Well, it's very helpful,
yes,
no doubt.
I know that you've been a serving officer before you actually went into Burma, but when you embarked in Liverpool in April 1943, did you know where you were actually heading for?
No, I hadn't a clue. It was on the Britannic, which was a very nice liner, we thought it was the Middle East, and we joined the convoy out in the Irish Sea and went down to Cape Town because the Suez was closed then. What I didn't realise before we got to Cape Town was that the Britannic had engine trouble and was left behind by the convoy, and as a result we were on our own in the South Atlantic, which was not a very good idea, but we were lucky. We arrived late in Cape Town, missed the next convoy. I'm not sure where that was going, but the one we were supposed to take. And we spent 6 weeks in Cape Town, which I enjoyed very much. And then we embarked again, and we still didn't know where we were going, for sure. We still thought it was the Middle East. And when we got round Cape Agulhas, which is the southernmost tip of Africa, we realized we were pointing northeast. And really, we ought to have been going more north for Africa. And then somebody told us that we were heading for Bombay. And of course, Bombay meant only one thing, and that was the Jap War in Burma.
When you first got to India, what happened to you then?
We went to a transit camp called Dulali, or Dulali as it was better known. I spent a week or two there, and the commanding officer of our regiment asked me if I'd take six special vehicles, which were these computer centres, as you might call them, for sound ranging and flash spotting. Six vehicles across India to a place called Ranchi in Bihar, which is not very far from Calcutta. Of course, I had no knowledge of the language. I'd hardly seen natives before. They were quite unusual for me. And I had a team of drivers, and we set off. And I asked for a map, and nobody got a map of India worthwhile. So I went down to the local bazaar and bought one, and used it to the best of my ability. But I found that a compass was more useful than anything, mainly because the signposts on the way tended to be turned round by Gandhi followers, who were non-violent followers. They were anti-British, so you couldn't rely on a signpost. And if you missed the right road, you could be 100 miles out. We did about 100 miles a day, and it took about 16 to 18 days altogether. So it was quite an experience, and on the Grand Trunk Road, which was anything but what it sounds, it was really nothing but potholes and dust. But it was a very important christening for me in a foreign land. I learned quite a lot about it and saw India in the raw.
Did you meet any other servicemen on your way across?
No. We went to the odd depot and got supplies and petrol and so on. But not really, no. No, it was quite a lonely trip.
And did you end up in Imphal?
No. This took us to Ranchi, where we, I suppose for 2 or 3 months, we must have engaged in jungle training there. And again, the commanding officer pulled me out and said, I want you to take an advance party to Imphal. I had no idea where Imphal was, actually, and I didn't know how far it was. I wasn't even sure how to get there. Anyway, I put together an advance party. I can't remember how many people it was, but probably about a dozen. And we set off by train for Calcutta. And at some stage, we got onto a narrow-gauge railway up the Brahmaputra River, which was used by tea planters and had been put in position by tea planters. But it was also a very important supply route for the Americans operating from Lido, and supplying China over the hump. They use this same little narrow gauge railway. The interesting thing about it, an exciting thing, was that the railway was fairly slow in the days of tea planting, and the Americans decided that everything had got to go twice the speed, which was fair enough. But as you went along, every few miles you'd see whole trains on their sides by the side of the track, which had just come off because, it was a pretty awful track. It was pretty bumpy. But that was just one of those things. You can just carry on. And that took us to a place called Dimapur. And it was at Dimapur that we transferred to road vehicles, lorries. And this was the beginning of a very long and hazardous journey from the Brahmaputra through the mountains all the way, about 130 miles, I should think, to Imphal, in the back of a lorry driven by a mad Indian. I don't know whether he was a Sikh or what, but and again, you had the experience of looking down the sides of the mountain from the lorry and seeing lorries lying at the bottom, just run out of road. We went through Kohima, but we didn't stop there, and the Kohima at that time, of course, was a super little hill station, very quiet and calm, and on to Imphal. And when eventually we got to Imphal, I got to work making the whole of the Imphal plain, which is a huge area, putting it on the same map grid. Maps at that time were a bit out of date, and I brought it up to date, ready for the artillery when they would arrive.
The commanders were Mountbatten and Slim, and they had obviously, they decided that you were going to defend Imphal virtually to the last man. Why had they chosen Imphal?
Well, Imphal is the gateway to India from northern Burma, or even from any part of Burma, really, apart from the southern way through the Arakan. But it was very, very important to the Japanese because I mentioned where I got on off the train at Dimapur, which was the American supply line. They particularly wanted to cut that supply line to China, which was going up to Lido. So for very many reasons, not only did they want to get into India and eventually link up with the Axis powers in the Middle East, but they particularly wanted to cut off that supply route to China. And Imphal was the best way in. There were two, I won't say good roads into Imphal, because they weren't, although one had been virtually metal, but the other wasn't. But they were the routes that they would take and did.
Can you tell me what you remember about the battle itself?
Well, when you refer to a battle, one always thinks of something like Alamein or Waterloo, but it was nothing like that at all. There were four divisions involved in this, and they were on four different fronts. Initially, there were three divisions, and I should add that fairly early on, when we'd been surrounded by three Japanese divisions, a fifth Indian division was flown in from Arakan. And this was the first time, so we were told, that a whole division had ever been transported from A to B. That included guns and mules and everything. It was a great help, of course. But there were four fronts, really. The two main ones, I suppose, were facing Burma and near the frontier. The and they were on the southern, southeast corner and the southwest corner, one at Pallel and one at Bishanpur. And the other two were in the northwest and northeast corners. And there must have been probably 30 or 50 miles between each one. But these were the routes that had to be held at all costs. And that was where the last stand was made, at a place called Bishanpur, where I believe the Gurkhas were awarded more VCs than in any other single battle in World War II. They were great soldiers, and I think I owe a lot to them myself. And the other one was on the Tamu Pallel Road, which was the southeast corner, and then there was the northwest and northeast, which was connecting up. The northwest was the route, our supply route, which by that time had been cut, and in particular, of course, at Kohima. And they, Kohima, as far as the Japs were concerned, was just a place where they just wanted to block, put a roadblock, and stop our supplies. But they found that they were up against incredible defences there, and very brave men. There were troops of the Assam Regiment, soon to be joined by the troops of the West Kent, Royal West Kent Regiment. And there were probably about 600 of them in all in Kohima. And they were facing up to 10,000, maybe a bit more, Japanese, which is unbelievable. But they held out for a couple of weeks, and they were eventually relieved by the 2nd British Division, which came down and eventually opened up our supply route. We had been in Imphal, surrounded and cut off for 3 months, and the divisions that I've referred to in the various corners of the Imphal plain were either on the plain or in the mountains, and they had retreated as far as they were going to, and it was that or nothing. So eventually, after 3 months, and the monsoon had started in a big way, Mountbatten said, you're used to stopping operations during a monsoon. From now on, you will continue operations in the monsoon. And so the battle started. This was a real battle, the end of the siege. And fortunately, our Indian divisions, and I think of 17th Indian Division, 20th Indian Division, 23rd Indian Division, and the 5th. They all did a magnificent job, and eventually pushed the Japanese back. This was the first time, the first big moment when the Japanese faced defeat. And from then on, they rolled right back.
And this is sort of June 1944?
That was, yes.
So in Europe, we just had the landings, and you had begun
right.
to push.
We didn't
the Japanese
really know much
there.
About what was going on in Europe at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we knew very little of what was going on in Europe, as indeed Europe knew very little of what was going on in our part of the world. We were sort of very remote.
I understand you actually pushed back 3 Japanese armies after that. Not you personally, or
yeah.
on your own.
Yeah. Well, these three
the
divisions.
14th Army.
Yes. Mind you, they were emasculated divisions by that time. They were in pretty poor shape. They were rolled back continuously to Rangoon and a bit beyond, before the atom bombs were dropped.
And you went down into the Arakan?
My battery from Imphal was ordered down to the Arakan, where the move forward had not taken place, and they were still battling the Japanese on the coast. So we went by road back through Kohima, which of course was a completely different place. It, to me, it looked like the Somme, the pictures I'd seen of World War One, exactly that. Trees disappeared, mud. And of course, I caught sight of the very temporary war memorial with the epitaph on it, which we all know, "When you go home." And that was imprinted on my mind instantly. I'd never read anything quite so appropriate. So on we went down to the Arakan, and by that time the Japs were being pushed forward. So we moved, we were on the move much of the time, down to a place called Akiab, and then transported by water down to an island called Ramree. And it was on Ramree that we were told, there's no point in going any further into Burma. You will now go back to India and train for the invasion of Malaya. And so we were withdrawn from Ramree Island to Madras, where we were training for the next invasion. And of course that didn't take place because of the bombs on Hiroshima. So it was, we travelled a long way in various ways, but I must say the news that we got when we were in near Madras at a place called Coimbatore, that the war had ended, was absolutely magnificent.
Thank you very much, Derek. Thank you.